kuang kuang aku nauku nauku kufu ada milele.
Broadcasting from high above the reserve, this is Radio Harambe. Jambo, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Radio Harambe podcast, brought to you by JamboEveryone.com. I am Dave McBride, broadcasting from the Radio Harambe studios, and joining me, as always, a man who spends much of his time scouring the jungle for that perfect cup of coffee. It's Safari Mike. Mike, how are you today?
Good, Dave. I'm in the Matterall. Do you know what the Matterall is?
God, I can't Google fast enough. Because it does sound familiar, but I can't. No, go ahead.
I am actually in Chile. Did you know that?
That's appropriate. Because as we're recording this, Chile just beat Spain in the World Cup. So I'm sure you can hear the screams of joy outside your window, correct?
Well, I'm way up in the mountains. We're studying the Puya Chilenas.
Got me.
I think this might be the first time on this show that we are... I was actually studying a plant. It's an evergreen perennial. It is also called the sheep-eating plant.
It eats sheep?
Sort of. It actually looks like a giant... I don't know if you've seen a medieval mace. It's this giant green plant that has all these spikes coming out the top.
Oh, no.
And what it does is that animals, such as sheep, can get caught up in the spikes and will die. And as they decompose at the base of the plant... It actually provides nutrients. So it kind of does eat sheep.
That is the craziest thing I've ever heard. Remind me not to buy one of those from my, have my gardener put one of those in the back of the car. Back of the, but.
Fair enough.
On today's show, we're going to discuss all the news from Disney's Animal Kingdom, the rest of Walt Disney World. And then in our final segment, we will be joined by Tom Bricker of the Disney Tourist Blog to discuss what we'll call his Animal Kingdom epiphany. But let's start off with the local news. And Mike, before we even get into that,
yes,
I want to start off with what is obviously a shameless plug.
What?
Something I'm really excited about. We have
what?
We have some great new t-shirts available for purchase. The very limited edition Warden Wilson Matua's Air Rangers shirts.
What?
Can now be purchased at JamboEveryone.com. Go to the blog. Once you click the blog, you'll see the posting on there. Have all the information on what you need to do. The cost is $25. That includes shipping to the continental U.S. If you're outside of that area, we can certainly make arrangements to mail them to you. Just going to alter the price a little bit to help us cover that. They're available in adult sizes, medium, large, and extra large. Like I said, go to the blog. You'll find it all there. Payments are made via PayPal. They look great. Our designer, whose name is Ed Peterson, has done just some brilliant stuff for us, and this is one of my favorite ones he's done. It's our latest attempt to raise funds for our conservation partners. 100% of the profits will be donated equally amongst all five of those organizations. They look great. They really look great. I love this shirt. Yeah. It looks really cool, so check it out.
It might even be cooler than the Radio Harambe ones.
I think it is. I think it is because there's a little bit of, you know, we're going to talk later on with Tom about nostalgia and how the Animal Kingdom may not have the kind of nostalgia some others, but this is for Animal Kingdom nostalgics.
Okay. We're working on it.
And I think, like, any longtime DAK fan, right, any Animal Kingdom fan is going to really like this.
And Warden Wilson, how could you not?
How could you? Yeah, exactly. Okay, so on to our first actual story, away from the shameless plugs. The Winged Encounters.
Yeah.
Appears to have opened. If you go to allears.net, you'll actually find a video there, about an 8.5 minute video of it. And it's kind of in a soft opening phase. It looks like the show is running in the morning. They're reporting 9:15 and 10:15, and then maybe even a couple in the afternoon, if possible, at 1 and 2. They're unofficial. I'm sure those times are going to change as things go on.
Sure.
But, Mike, before I say anything else, I say, wow, this looks great. I love it.
Yeah, Yeah, it looks pretty cool. I mean, there's a lot of macaws flying around. And
a lot.
It looks like wherever you are on Discovery Island, you'll get to see them. They're obviously, when you see the video, you'll see there are certain spots, there are certain areas where they land for a little sort of keeper talks, kind of, where the people will give you a little talk about what they have going on there. And you might want to be around that particular one of those types of poles. And if you see the video, you'll see what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
But yeah, it looks cool. But even if you're just walking around Discovery Island during these time periods, you're going to see a flock of macaws flying over your head, you know, as you're grabbing barbecue or whatever it is you're doing.
Imagine. Yeah. I mean, just as far as just adding to the overall immersive experience, if they're doing this 5 or 6 times a day, you're bound to be walking around the animal kingdom when a flock, and Mike says a flock, there's a more than a few here.
Up to 20 or so.
Up to 20 or so of these gorgeous macaws of all different species of macaws. There's at least 4 or 5 different that I saw on this video.
Yeah, I think there was up to 6 is what the original posting on the Disney Parks blog said as to the number of different species. I think it was 6.
Yeah, I mean, just you feel like you're walking through the jungle now. wait till you see those guys flying overhead screaming.
Yeah,
and the cool thing that I like about it, Mike, is that it's what I would say is it's not a dog and pony show.
Mm-hmm.
It's really just a short sort of conservation message about macaws. Now, I'm going to kind of put you on the spot on this. I probably should have told you I was going to ask you this question before we start here. But one of the things they talked about, Mike, was one of the biggest threats, if not the biggest threat facing these macaws, is the pet trade.
Right.
People taking these pets out of the wild, taking these birds out of the wild and making them pets, which then leads a lot of people to the question, well, what are these birds doing there? So I guess.
Oh, you mean how did they get them?
Well, Mike, I guess my question is, can you tell us the difference between a pet and what's happening here?
In terms of how these people got their macaws?
In terms of how something like this actually helps the species,
Well, it's a learning experience. Yeah, I mean, the problem with the pet trade, and I don't know how far they get into this on this particular show, but it's not run by professionals. It's usually people, you know, poor indigenous people in the area where, you know, the Colombian jungles or other Amazon jungles or South America somewhere, where they have to go through a process of capturing birds. In their nests, they'll grab eggs, they'll grab babies. And you see all sorts of stats where up to, you know, some people quote 20, other people quote up to 100 birds that have to die before one gets into a pet shop. So every pet that you see, every illegally caught macaw in a pet store, whether it be in the United States or some other place, there's 100 dead birds, or up to 100 dead birds, that had to die in the process of trying to get a macaw alive, captured from its mother and brought into, or captured from its parents and from the nest and brought into, and, you know, hidden in crates, smuggled into countries, and then brought into the pet shop. So what you know, obviously these people are doing is they're educating people about that, as well as other issues with macaws, such as habitat destruction and things like that.
Right.
And these macaws are not illegally caught from the wild. They're, you know, captive bred animals that are, you know, raised by, you know, professionals who know what it takes to raise macaws, know what it takes for a chick to survive. So it's I think that answers what the question you were asking.
Yes, it does. Yes.
So.
And if anybody has seen the Radio Harambe Studios recently, they'll know that right next to my computer screen, I have a statue of Jose from the Tiki Room sitting here with me. And Jose approves. So we will move along to the next story. This week, the Disney Parks blog told us about a new animal experience at Rafiki's Planet Watch called It All Started with a Mouse. Of course, it doesn't feature any mice. But according to the blog, this is what it says. It says, It All Started with a Mouse showcases Walt Disney's lifelong love of the animal world. During the show, Conservation Station's animal ambassadors, including sheep, parrots, porcupines, birds of prey, and coony pigs? Is that how you
sure.
say it? Okay,
sure.
Good. Yeah, help tell stories and make appearances in, around, and even above the audiences as the cast members share natural history fun facts, conservation messages, and inspiring and fun calls to action. After the show, guests have an exclusive opportunity to meet and talk to some of the stars of the show and are encouraged to capture once-in-a-lifetime memories with plenty of photographs. So it looks like we're adding some more stuff over to Rafiki's.
Yeah, I mean, this is obviously replacing the animal, I believe it was called Animal Encounter show that was there, where it would have a couple of animal keepers come out with animals similar to this, such as sheep and porcupine, although I don't recall them ever having birds of prey, but or flying around you, like they're saying it's going on now at this particular show. I saw the stage, they redeveloped it kind of. It looks, before it was just kind of utilitarian. It wasn't really, you know,
yeah, it was just there. Yeah.
It didn't really have any pizzazz. It was just essentially a green stage. Yeah. They've added some stuff to make it a little bit jazzier, I suppose. I'm not sure how much different it is other than that from the old Animal Encounter show. And I'm not really sure, I mean, other than using a Walt Disney, you know, quote, it all started with a mouse, which, right, you know, obviously every Disney fan knows. I'm not sure what it has to do with Walt Disney besides that.
Right. Maybe a few lines in the spiel is probably about all there is.
I guess.
Cause certainly nothing of what of the rest of that description has anything to do with Walt and his love for animals.
I always felt, I'm sorry, Dave, I always felt that Rafiki's Planet Watch would be a good place to showcase, to some degree, Walt's fascination with nature and the nature documentary. I mean, One Man's Dream is obviously what it is, a shrine to Walt, and it's great. But I always thought they should have something there that, I mean, really, Walt Disney was the first person to do the nature documentary.
He invented it.
Yeah, much. Which is all over TV nowadays. I mean, it's a major television programming. I mean, there are channels dedicated to it and all that kind of stuff. I always thought there should be at least something there. The Seal Island, which was the first one, or something like that around. So maybe this is a little step in that direction, which I like.
Of all the things that people don't associate with Walt Disney and the innovations he made in the entertainment business, a lot of people don't associate that, and it is a very big one. I mean, Mike was saying, we have an entire network now devoted to a medium that essentially Walt invented.
Several. I mean, there's Animal Planet, there's Nature, Natural Geographic. Right. There's several of them. Yeah.
Right. I mean, so it's. I think you're 100% right. That would be a great little kind of addition. Just a little side note on the show. It appears that as of now, it's only running once a day.
Right.
At 11:30. So, you got to kind of plan around it because it's only going once a day. Maybe they'll add to that as time goes on. Who knows?
We'll see how popular it is, I guess. They just started it, so.
Yeah, and it came out of nowhere. We had no idea it was coming, but maybe the nature of the show is not so involved, but we'll find out. As soon as we get some more information, we'll pass it along.
Mm-hmm.
The next story I have, it refers to coffee. Changes and tweaks at the Animal Kingdom seem to just keep coming along. Now it looks like construction has begun on a new coffee kiosk on Discovery Island near the bridge to Dinoland USA. Walls are already up in the area. And Mike, WDW Magic was, I don't want to directly say they were saying this because the way they wrote it was sort of a little cagey, but it seemed to be they're speculating that this may be Joffrey's. And
absolutely.
And not the soon-to-be-coming Starbucks stuff.
Absolutely. First of all, Starbucks is never going to be a kiosk. It's just not.
Okay.
It's going to be a store. And I think what this is, essentially what this is they're taking away the coffee kiosk that was by the tip board over by Disney Outfitters.
Right.
And as, you know, we've talked about before, they're actually kind of expanding out the Disney Outfitters to create more retail space.
Right.
And they're getting rid of the tip board. Right. As well, and they're getting rid of the coffee kiosk. This is essentially just a replacement for the coffee kiosk that was used to be on the, you know, right in front, right by where the Wilderness Explorers, you can get the badges and all that, get the book and all that. Starbucks is going by, and I don't think there's any question that it's going to be Creature Comforts. They haven't said it, but I mean, they're talking about closing Creature Comforts for an extended amount of time. And they're what we keep hearing is that a half of that is going to be turned over to the Starbucks. And if they're going to turn over half of a retail store to a Starbucks, Disney is loath to remove retail space without, you know, getting it back. And that is the extension of the Disney Outfitters. That's just going to be a bigger, more of a,
right.
Kind of like the feature shop, kind of like Emporium, you know, that's going to be really big. So I think that's what we're seeing here. We're seeing Joffrey's moving over there. We're seeing Future Comforts going to become half of it will become the Starbucks. And then, you know, Disney Outfitters is going to be that much bigger.
Have you seen the tip board recently?
No. Why? What's going on?
It has like a big advertisement for Viva Gaia on it.
Oh, yes, I did see it. Well, you know, Disney, I think, is getting away from the tip boards anyway.
Yeah,
I mean, they're
unnecessary now, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, who looks at the tip? I mean, you're going to go all the way back to the front to see how long Expedition Everest line is. It's just not – it never was a very good way to do it, other than when you first walked into the park just to see where you wanted to go.
Yeah.
And now with – well, I mean, everybody has apps on their phones, right, whether it's the Disney one, the – you know, or whoever else is doing them.
Right.
You know, it just seems – pointless to have a tip board anyway, really.
It also seems like this is kind of a way to move people into that realm anyway.
Yeah, cool.
Since our last show, Mike, we have got, I'm not sure you've seen it, gotten to see video footage of the Harambe Nights event. And
I did.
Specifically all of the show.
I saw some of the other stuff, you know, going around the show.
They have the entire nearly hour-long presentation online and in a couple of different places. Just put it in there and you'll find it.
Mm-hmm.
You'll Google it and you'll find it. I just wanted to talk a little bit about some of the impressions that we're getting off this. I'll let you talk about the not show part and I'll talk about the show part.
Okay.
My impressions of the show, let me say this. Not being a perspective of seeing it live myself, and I'm sure that would change things. It does seem like it's quite a cool show, but perhaps could have been a lot more so. Some of the songs that they use in there, some of the performances, there's especially the use of a song called He Lives in You, which is a fantastic song that was not in the movie, but was used in a couple of different places, including...
It's in the play, right?
It's in the play, but it even predates the play. It was on an album that came out called Rhythm of the Pride Lands that many people probably don't have, but is a terrific album. It's sort of kind of like riffs on the Lion King sort of stuff. Really good stuff, and it's the use of that song was really great. But I think actually from looking at it that it's, you know, almost a little bit of a letdown. I mean, you have a celebrity performer, or a celebrity narrator, you have an orchestra, you have a chorus, you have actors and singers on the stage, yet you devote a large portion of the presentation to clips from the film. And it just puzzles me why they would do that. Listen, don't get me wrong. I love The Lion King. It is, to me, it is a masterpiece in the Disney lexicon. It's actually my favorite of all the animated films. And, I mean, I love it, but I still feel that, like, a hard ticket performance needs to have something more than clips and a 20-year-old script.
Uh-huh.
You know, so, you know, at first I was really kind of gung-ho on the Harambe Nights thing. Then I saw the kind of underwhelming show. And I think a lot of people are saying, and this is where we're going to throw it over to you now, a lot of people are saying that it's not the show that's the star, it's kind of the party, you know, it's the rest of it. But
yet there are still some,
you know, mixed reviews about that as well, correct?
Yeah, I have heard all sorts of things with regards to the, most people say the atmosphere, that the park itself at night is, you know, A+, and, you know, I think we all agree with that.
Yeah.
You know, if you discount the show to some degree, that's, you know, not all that big of a deal, and maybe, I don't know, $30 worth of the $120 that you're spending or whatever you want to say, then you actually have to turn to the food and the alcohol. I've heard pretty good reviews from the alcohol, and I've heard that, you know, they're pretty, there's a lot of bars, you know, a lot of small, you know, kiosks or whatever you want to call them, mm-hmm. Carts for beer, which is African, and the wines, and as well as a rum drink using jungle juice. And I've heard that, at least for the first couple of nights, that the bartenders have a heavy pour, which is always good. So I've heard great things about that. But the food, I've heard mixed reviews. Some people love it. Some people, I mean, I've heard people say, oh, it's, you know, better than Boma, and it's just terrific. And then other people have been, you know, the flavors are just not there, and it's just not all that great. So I've heard very mixed reviews about the food, which is a, if you want to say the show is really not that big of a deal, then that's an important aspect of the party atmosphere for sure.
Yeah, and it seems to me like some people are saying, you know, the criticism of it is that they are obviously going for the Sanaa, Boma, Jiko thing, mm-hmm. but that it doesn't quite get up to that level.
Right.
So you then have to question, when you consider the price of Boma and the price of Sanaa, whether or not, you know, like you're saying, if you are a dyed-in-the-wool Lion King fan, you're going to love this show. Let me put it mm-hmm. that way. If you are not a dyed-in-the-wool Lion King fan, if you're just a big fan of the movie, even like I am, I mm-hmm. think you were kind of hoping that it would be a little bit more. This sounds weird because I don't want Festival of the Lion King done. You want something different. But it seems to me like your standard 25-minute Festival of the Lion King show kind of hits the mark a little bit more as far as emotionally, you know, as far right. as, you know, the performance-wise, the wow factor. So, you know, it's just kind of strange. It's, you know, maybe it'll change as time goes on. Maybe this show will move around as we get past the 20th anniversary release of the DVD or whatever it is. That
yeah, maybe they'll change it up, yeah.
Who knows? But yeah. Maybe they'll make it a Jungle Book one.
Well, a couple of things I have heard about it that people who are going to it should take note is that it ends at 10:30, right?
Right.
Now, there apparently, if by the Tree of Life, towards the end of the night, uh-huh. there are characters that'll be there for, you know, maybe a quick meet and greet or a quick hello or whatever, you know, whatever it is. But I've heard that they leave at 10:30. So if you stay till at Harambe until the very last moment and then start walking out of the park, you might actually miss it. If that's a big deal to you, so be it. And also, unlike some of the other parties that you have at Disney where, you know, there are long lines for characters and that's half the night is in line for character meet and greets, that's not really the case here in this particular show or this particular event. The characters actually walk around, which is very unusual nowadays for yeah. Disney. It's what they used to always do. But nowadays, you know, Goofy in his safari outfit will be walking around and mixing it up with people.
Right.
You know, Mickey, Minnie, I know Timon is there, and whatever, Rafiki, whatever. So that's fun. And also, there are special lights on the Tree of Life to signify, I guess, the stars that are all the, you know, the dead kings or whatever it is that Mufasa mm-hmm. tells right. Simba. So make sure you check that out, too.
And they all are blue.
Yeah, I've heard that about, you know, people are saying, oh, this is what the coming of Avatar. Yeah, it's not Avatar. Give me a break.
Yep, but all I'm saying is that it might come in useful a few years down the road.
I see. They're saving money by buying the blue lights now.
I'm just saying. When they had to choose a color, it made a lot of sense to go with blue just in case we needed to do something later on. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, I'm not buying it. But go ahead.
It also appears that they've done pretty well with this because the sellouts are coming sort of fast and furious.
Yeah, this week, which we're recording on a Wednesday night, I heard, I guess it was yesterday, that this coming weekend's have sold out.
Yeah.
And we're not even in the truly busy time of the year. So if you are, you know, if you're planning on going down in, I don't know, middle of July, let's say, where it's even more crowded than it is now, don't wait until the last minute to try to get a ticket. You know, decide now whether what you want to do it and jump on board. First of all, if you wanted premium seats, they're all gone. From what I understand, there's not another premium seat available for the rest of the run of the show. So, you know, if you are going in July or early August, you might want to make up your mind now.
Absolutely. And speaking of Harambe Nights, I guess it was probably inevitable that the event would have some kind of ripple effect on other parts of the park. This week, we also found out, or actually last week, that the Tusker House will be altering its time schedule a bit. Most likely to open seating availability earlier in the day to accommodate those who can't get later reservations due to the fact that I guess they're closing the restaurant early because it is part of the show. It's part right. of part of the pre and post show parties. Lunch is now extended by 45 minutes every day to 3:30. On Saturday nights, those are the nights of the show. It will be only lunch, but it's served all the way up to 4:30, and the restaurant closes at that point. But it doesn't appear there's any changes made to the character breakfast times. So just mm-hmm. kind of a little tweak if you're looking to book reservations or something, that might be something to keep in mind during the summertime. So.
And the only other thing I would add to that is I keep hearing rumblings, and I'm not sure how – I'm not saying that this is a set-in-stone kind of thing, but I keep hearing that they are contemplating moving the Tusker House – making the dinner at the Tusker House characters too, because for whatever reason, it's only breakfast and lunch right now.
Right.
But as the park is – you know, the hours are going later and later, and, you know, 8 o'clock is becoming the new norm. Don't be surprised if sooner or later it's a character – every meal is a character meal.
I think that's it for the local news, Mike. Is there anything else that you're hearing? Or?
I don't think so. I think we're good.
All right. We'll take a little break, and then we'll turn the show over to Safari Mike, who brings us the world news. So stay tuned. Jennifer Green of Destinations in Florida is the official travel partner of Radio Harambe and JomboEveryone.com. Jen can do everything you need done in order to book your next Walt Disney World vacation and have the time of your life. She is an expert in everything Disney and will remove all the stress of booking your trip. And she is as committed to conservation as we are. So every vacation you book, or even every quote you request, means Jen and Destinations in Florida will make a donation to the Jumbo Everyone conservation effort. You can contact Jen directly by emailing her at jennifer.g@destinationsinflorida.com or by calling her directly at 443-424-0181. You can also head over to JomboEveryone.com and click the Destinations in Florida icon to get your vacation started. Seriously, what can be better than booking a Disney World vacation while helping to save wildlife? Welcome back to Radio Harambe. It is time once again for the world news. And with that, our own world traveler, Safari Mike.
Jumbo Dave. Today for the world news, we'll go to the Resort Loop and Liberty Square. But first, let's go to Echo Lake, where Disney has actually confirmed that the American Idol experience, or whatever the hell it's called, will be closing in early January.
You didn't even get past the news story before the snark began.
It opened in 2009, several years after the peak of the show, which was a huge criticism when it opened. It opened in 2009 as the ratings were plummeting.
Duh.
But I will give Disney credit that they didn't keep this dragging on like the Prince Caspian thing over, you know, across the park. That, you know, should have died a death years before that did. They are pulling the plug on it after only 5 years. The real interesting thing about it, though, however, and I don't think really anybody cares about the American Idol experience. I mean, they had trouble filling the shows with performers all the time.
Yeah, it was
a bad idea, and at least yeah. Disney recognized it and pulled it after only a few years. But anyway, it borders Sounds Dangerous. The old theater for Sounds Dangerous, which, of course, they use just for check-ins now at Jedi Training Academy. So the speculation is, of course, that's a big chunk of real estate in the middle of your park, American Idol Experience, and then Sounds Dangerous, two huge sound stages that will be essentially empty unless, of course, they're going to add something to it. And the other hot rumor you're hearing, and Disney has not confirmed this, but we're hearing that cast members are being told at Indiana Jones that might be closing early next year as well. And of course, everybody assumes since now you're talking about everything that surrounds Star Tours, we are, you know, maybe getting closer to them shutting down that sort of section of the park to truly make a Star Wars land.
Well, I mean, I think that's kind of a no-brainer. I want to pile on Disney a little bit for the American Idol just because it's fun. But it was a terrible idea to begin with when they
it was
had
terrible.
It.
I mean, it was terrible.
You know, like you were saying, the ratings were going down, yet they still invested what must have been a fortune in that theater. You know, it was a mind.
Well,
it was a silly thing to do.
It was a silly thing to do. I don't know if I agree that they invested a fortune on it.
Theater, in terms of a theater. I mean, they didn't put animatronics in there. It wasn't, but they invested money into creating this theater. For a show that was whose shelf life was already towards its expiration date, you know,
right?
It just didn't make any sense to do it. But
no, none, zero. I agree with you wholeheartedly. It was a stupid idea.
We can only hope that the direction that the animal kingdom is going in is the same kind of direction that the studios is going in.
The only credit I will give them, though, on this is that in other instances where things have well passed their prime and are due to be shut down. For example, the one I gave you was the Prince Caspian thing. You know, the Narnia thing that they had forever over it before they changed it with that stupid Legend of Jack Sparrow thing.
Right.
But, I mean, at least with this, the contract was up in 5 years and they pulled the plug right away. Right. And apparently there was a contract with the company. So as soon as that was up, they yanked it. So at least I give them credit for realizing, and you know, maybe part of that credit is the realization that that's where they want to build Star Wars Land, so they, you know,
or that nobody was there.
Yeah, so, but thankfully the American Idol experience will be gone shortly.
Absolutely. Good. What's next?
Let's talk about the monorail real quick. The monorail loops, they're going to actually go, as they're trying to work on it and create more of an automation work on it to help with, obviously, the problems that they're having with the monorail. It's going to have a set schedule no matter what time the park's closed. So the for people who are going soon, the Magic Kingdom Resort Loop will start at 8:30 and end at midnight. The Magic Kingdom Express Loop starts at 9:30 and ends at 11:30, which is kind of odd that it would start at 9:30. So people at the Ticket and Transportation Center for Rope Drop are out of luck with the Express monorail. Huh. And the Epcot loop starts from 9 a.m. and ends at 11 p.m. So they're going to, no matter what time, and we all know Magic Kingdom doesn't have set hours. Epcot's really the only one that does. No matter what time the parks are open, so, you know, when July 4th, when the Magic Kingdom's open at like 3 a.m. or whatever it is, these monorails will be closing at 11, 11:30, and 12. So keep that in mind.
The unfortunate thing is, and Mike, I think we've talked about this before, is that we all see the handwriting on the wall here for the monorail. I mean, everybody sees the scale backs, the maintenance issues. You know, they're never going to add to that. That's for sure. Everybody, you know, gone or we went from what we used to do is speculate and hope for additions to the monorail, connecting other parts of the complex, to now just hoping it survives. You know, that it doesn't get closed entirely. Because those of us, you know, who do love it don't want to see it go. But it is an ambitious thing to have, and it is probably a very costly thing to have there, too. But
yeah.
What's weird is that you can get on the monorail to and from Epcot at opening before you can go to the Magic Kingdom.
The Express.
Correct. I mean, I don't see the logic there, but there must be some sort of... there must be some sort of mathematics that tell them why that, you know, will work for them.
I'm not sure what it is, but keep in mind, don't forget that they've also built the additional boat dock from the Ticket and Transportation Center to the Magic Kingdom. So I think they're encouraging as much as they can people who are there if you're there for rope drop now, you have no choice.
Right.
From the Ticket and Transportation Center to get you on the boats to take you to and from the Magic Kingdom.
Right. Cool. What's next?
Let's go to Liberty Square.
Liberty Tree Tavern?
Nope. Liberty Square. I never go to Liberty Tree Tavern. If I want Stouffer's meal, I could buy it at $5.99 at the supermarket. I don't need to go. I don't need to spend $30 at the Liberty Tree Tavern. Yankee Trader, which is that little store right next to sort of the Haunted Mansion, is going down for an extensive refurb. Starting July 7th, and it will not reopen until October 1st. And the thought is that this store is going to completely turn over to be a Haunted Mansion store. It will only sell Haunted Mansion merchandise. It will also be the place where you'll be able to get on-ride photographs and purchase those from the Haunted Mansion. I don't know if you remember this, Dave, but you know, some time ago they were talking about being able to buy photos of, you know, that section at the end where the hitchhiking ghosts are being goofy on your time in your vehicle. Mm-hmm. Apparently, you'll be able to get a picture of that and buy it for, I'm sure, an outrageously high price, and with a souvenir cardboard, you know, carrying case or whatever it is.
Right.
And anyway, so the store by October 1st might be a completely Haunted Mansion store, and you'll be able to start buying those things.
I think we're all kind of for a Haunted Mansion store. Are you?
I'm fine with it. Yeah, I'm fine with it. The Yankee trader really didn't have too much else that I was interested in. I mean, it usually had a few Haunted Mansion items on it just because it was right next door to it.
Yeah.
And you also had that cart right outside of the Haunted Mansion that sold a couple of T-shirts or whatever. Yeah. So in this sort of age where they're in the Market Co-op has recently opened, where there's all this cool Adventureland stuff and, right. you know, Mr. Toad stuff and all that kind of thing. You know, I hope they have a wide variety of Haunted Mansion stuff. I think it'd be a surefire hit.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of where I was going with that. I mean, not just have a store, but to have a, therefore, more variety in the merchandise, you know, dedicated to the Haunted Mansion.
I mean, of all the attractions, I can't think of another one that is more popular in terms of souvenirs.
Pirates?
Maybe Pirates might be the only one close. I mean, I can't think of anything else that would garnish that kind of souvenir, you know, variety and, you know, people just gobbling it up kind of stuff.
Man, I made a Frozen attraction yet, so...
Yeah, that's true. I don't want to talk about that.
Yeah. Wait a minute. I don't want to let you off the hook of this, but when it comes to Frozen, where are we on the latest of Norway turning into Frozen?
It's just a rumor. I mean, there's no additional. I haven't really heard. It's well, you know what? I take that back. I do take that back. There is another thing that has come down the pike that I've heard. And that's actually my next story. You want me to get to that?
Yes.
Sure. As we've discussed in past, the FastPass Plus at Hollywood Studios and Epcot are tiered. And there are certain items, you know, certain attractions that are in Tier 1 where you can get one FastPass and certain attractions that are Tier 2 where you can get two different FastPasses. They're moving some stuff around. So the Great Movie Ride, which was originally a Tier 2 attraction... has now been moved to Tier 1 at the Hollywood Studios to join Rock and Roller Coaster and Toy Story Midway Mania.
Okay.
The only reason I can think that they would do that, and Beauty and the Beast Stage Show, for some reason that I can never figure out, is also a Tier 1. I guess they need to have things that are, you know, Toy Story Mania, there's no ride, there's no height restriction.
Right.
But the other thing I've heard is that the Great Movie Ride has really taken a beat with this FastPass Plus in terms of, like, really screwing up the ride, the lines and stuff like that. And maybe by moving it to Tier 1, where nobody on Earth is going to select it over Toy Story Midway Mania or the Rock and Roller Coaster if they're thrill ride fans, will kind of alleviate some of that problem. That's one thing I've heard. Now, let's move over to Epcot, where Living with the Land, which may have a similar situation as the Great Movie Ride, has been moved from Tier 2 to Tier 1. And from Tier 1 down to Tier 2, they've moved the character spot in Future World. And also Maelstrom has moved from Tier 1 down to Tier 2. And I've heard scuttlebutt that this is the first step in putting it on a refurb list to move it over to a Frozen attraction. I hope to God it's not true.
God.
But I did hear that. I did hear that. I'm not sure how that really plays out on why they would move it to Tier 2 before a refurb. But I actually like that it's moved to Tier 2 because I was never going to pick it over Soarin' or Test Track. And now it becomes an obvious choice for my Tier 2 to pick the Maelstrom at Epcot. But it is what it is. That's that they're sort of moving things around on the tier system.
I hate Frozen and I've never seen it.
How could you possibly hate it if you've never seen it?
Because if this is what's going to happen, I hate Frozen.
Yeah. Because it's a cute movie.
It does not belong in Epcot.
No, well, that's for sure. It does not belong in Epcot. But by the same token, does the Three Caballeros?
No.
Okay.
I don't see that to be such a great attraction either.
Okay.
So, I mean, I think the Three Caballeros is exactly a good example of why you wouldn't do this.
Yeah. How about moving the Ratatouille ride from Disneyland Paris to replace Impressions de France?
Well, you see, that's a little different because it depends on how the Ratatouille ride... First of all, I've said straight from the beginning, I do not want e-ticket thrill ride attractions in World Showcase.
I agree with
you. Can there be no place left where we don't have that? Where we can just have a relaxing time without commandos pushing me over to get to their fast pass times without listening to screaming in the distance, you know, can there just be one spot that's like right. that. And the World Showcase has been that, and I want it to stay that way. So I don't, but having said that, depending on what the Ratatouille ride ends up being, if it ends up being like a mouse view world, a mouse eye view of Paris, then, you know, it can work better than the Three Caballeros did. Because
if it's a clone of the ride that they're building in Paris, it's actually, you're supposed to be like the mouse-sized version of the inside the restaurant, being chased around by the chef, and, you know, you're on a trackless system, so it's a little bit, it's right. not a straight track, so there's a little bit more maneuverability, and it's supposedly be an interesting ride system. You know, the thing I say with it is that Ratatouille at least takes place in Paris. Frozen does not take place in Norway.
No.
So,
and Three Caballeros didn't take place in Mexico, if I'm not mistaken, either.
That may be true.
I think that was Argentina, but I could be wrong.
But yeah, see, that was the big, that's the big problem I have with the Frozen. First, I love Maelstrom, and I think more people are more nostalgic, and we'll talk about nostalgia later. But
I'm
more nostalgic with Maelstrom than they ever were with the River of Time over in Mexico, and certainly Impressions de France. I mean, it's like a morgue in there sometimes, and nobody ever goes in there.
But it's good.
So, no, that's fine. I like the Impressions de France. It's a nice theater. It's comfortable. It's 20 minutes of it. Sit down, air conditioned, and a nice seat. It's a good movie, good soundtrack. I like it.
I do too.
I do like it a lot. But I mean, at least with those two attractions, you're not taking away things that the attraction that many people enjoy and, you know, relate to in Epcot. As opposed to Maelstrom, which I think a lot of people do. I mean, Soarin's usually one test track, but, you know, Maelstrom is often the third favorite ride of many people.
Yeah, I would agree. And I mean, I don't mind change. I don't mind addition. I don't mind, you know, work being done. I've never been one like that. I've ridden Maelstrom 1,000 times. I don't mind if they make it something else. I don't mind if they update it.
Right.
I do mind if they turn it into a cross-marketing campaign.
Right.
And then therefore invite people into giant lines spewing out into the World Showcase promenade, which that's what I don't want. So is that
that's
it?
True.
Is I mean, that it for the World News?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you to some degree that World Showcase is sort of, you know, it should be a more quiet place. It should be more like the Animal Kingdom, really.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's all I want. It's one place left.
You have the Animal Kingdom, you have World Showcase. They're a lot alike.
Yeah, they are.
Maybe we'll talk about that later. Maybe,
perhaps we will. I think that's it. Is that all for
yes,
this? Okay, we're going to take another short break. And when we come back, we're going to be joined by Tom Bricker from the Disney Tourist Blog to talk about his epiphany on the Animal Kingdom. So stay tuned for that. Coming back in just a minute.
Hi, Explorer Mickey here. Did you know there are only a few thousand great green macaws left in the wild? There are such beautiful birds, but people are causing them to disappear. But we can help. The ARA Project works to save the habitats for lots of different kinds of macaws. They also help rescue birds and even hatch baby chicks to keep the population growing. So we need to help them do all of that good stuff by going to the ARAproject.org and making a donation. Every little bit counts.
And welcome back to Radio Harambe. It is time for our feature section of the show, and on today's show we welcome a terrific travel writer, Tom Bricker. Tom is from the Disney Tourist Blog, and we are bringing him on the show today for one very specific article he wrote several months ago called "I Was Wrong About Disney's Animal Kingdom." As you can probably gather from the title, it was an article where he turned away from the dismissive attitude of the park all too often found among Disney bloggers and podcasters, and at last joined the forces of good. Since, obviously, Mike and I do not come anywhere near sharing that dismissive attitude, we thought we would get someone on who could perhaps help us not only to understand why so many Disney pundits speak poorly of what we think is the most amazing theme park on the planet, but also maybe let those folks know exactly what they are missing. It took Tom and I quite a while to get this interview finally into a reality, but as far as I'm concerned, the article is as pertinent today as it was when he wrote it. So welcome, sir. Thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for thank you guys for having me on.
Now, before we get too specific, let's start with this. Before we talk about your turn away from the dark side there, so to speak, talk a little bit about your attitude towards the park before this, what would we call it, an epiphany or something like that, before you were moved to do this.
I think my attitude was basically based on an apples-to-apples comparison of the other three major theme parks of Walt Disney World. And I think that's actually what a lot of people probably do and why they may not hold Animal Kingdom in such high regard. And I mean, when you do that, I think that Animal Kingdom is just such a very different theme park in both tone, substance, and I mean, really in just about every regard, that it doesn't compare. I don't want to say it doesn't compare well to the other parks, but it's a tough comparison to make. So if your baseline going in is the other three parks, I mean, especially like the Magic Kingdom, Animal Kingdom is a bit of a tough sell, or at least something that is different. I mean, I know that we're now, 15 years after the fact from it opening, but still for a lot of people, it is just, it's a very different type of theme park. And I think for people like myself, maybe who grew up in the Disney theme parks and are now older and at the age where they're having their own kids, they may also not have the same emotional attachment to Animal Kingdom as they have for, say, Magic Kingdom or Epcot.
Well, let's compare it just while we're still sort of in this pre-epiphany mode. Let's compare it a little bit to Hollywood Studios, which at the time was MGM. My question is, when the Animal Kingdom kind of opened, a lot of people were dismissive of the fact that there was only a couple things to do. You know, there wasn't a lot of attractions, wasn't a lot of options. This is exactly the same thing one could have said about MGM when it opened. Yet MGM sort of shrugged off that that sort of moniker or that description, you know, fairly quickly by adding a lot of things. And even though the Animal Kingdom added a lot of things, you know, it's still in a very similar time frame. I mean, by 2005, 2006, we're only, you know, less than 10 years into its existence. It had added a lot of pretty significant stuff. Still, it wasn't able to shake that half-day park thing, a phrase never ascribed to MGM, even though it really was a half-day park for a number of years there.
Well, I think now you're starting to see that phrase pop up more and more with the studios. But I think the big thing is probably the what of what was added. So you use the word things there, and I mean, that's an appropriate, you know, it's a broad catch-all. I think a lot of the criticism people have had for Animal Kingdom has not been that they haven't added or that there's a true total lack of substance, but it's what that substance consists of, and that it's not rides or that it's not you could come back and say, well, you know, the studios has a lot of stage shows too, and that's a fair point. It does, okay. But I think there's more perceived variety in what the studios offers as compared to Animal Kingdom. And I say perceived variety because I think it's perception. It's not necessarily the reality of what's there, but there is that perception that there's greater variety and that a lot of what's at Animal Kingdom is animal exhibits. And I think that the Not a Zoo campaign, I don't know if that's how you pronounce it, but you know, what it breaks down to, Not a Zoo,
right,
was trying to sort of raise public awareness and try to break that perception that, you know, hey, this isn't just a bunch of animal exhibits like you'd find at a zoo. There's more to it. So, I mean, the fact that campaign exists in the first place probably suggests that there was a reason for it to exist. Otherwise, you know, it wouldn't have. And so that's the perception of the park, I think. And that's the perception I had. And, you know, for a long time, I felt like, well, it does feel a lot like a zoo. And there is a lot in common here with a zoo, and it's sort of a hybrid theme park and zoo. And when I say zoo, I don't just mean like, you know, some garden variety zoo or something. And I don't feel that way anymore anyway, so regardless. But, I mean, that's what the perception was. So, I mean, that is what it is.
Right. Now, let's move on to your epiphany. so to use a phrase.
Yeah.
I want you to describe, because you eloquently write, without, you know, people should go back and read the article, but because you get a lot more information there. But I want you to describe for me, you pull in another trip, I believe, to Paris that kind of helped you sort of see the light, to sound patronizing there.
Yeah, no, that's fine. Yeah. So I actually think there are a few things that, favorable things that you compare Animal Kingdom to, that, you know, sort of help it out and make it easier to see it as a solid park. And Paris was one of those things. I think that there are actually, in the United States, I think World Showcase is a good comparison, that part of Epcot. And I think Disneyland Paris in general, from the perspective of the detail that that park has. And then I'd also say that certain areas of Tokyo Disney Sea, which is probably the highest praise in the theme park world you could heap on another park, Animal Kingdom is reminiscent of those places. And this is strictly in terms of how the park is built. It's not in its layout, but how much detail there is and how it should be approached. I think that a lot of people in the community who are, like, I guess, theme park commandos, you might call them, really overlook this type of the intricacies that are in those three places that I mentioned. And really, you know, if you just want to go from attraction to attraction, cross off, like, the big rides or attractions, like, you know, the Everest, the Cali River Rapids, Dinosaur, things like that, you really only have a few of those things to checklist style cross off. But I'm looking at the article now, and I said it's sort of like a fine line meant to be sipped, not chugged. And I think that's the way to approach all three of those areas. And I mean, it holds true to Animal Kingdom. There's a ton to see if you really take time to slow down and see all of these things. And I mean, I think that's especially true in sort of to get into the animal exhibit part of this with things like Maharaja Jungle Trek. I mean, I don't believe I'd ever done that. I might have done it in like 1999 or so when I was a kid with my parents. I don't recall. If I had, that's not just an animal exhibit, even though it ostensibly is an animal exhibit. It's ruins. It's there's so much more to it than just a basic animal exhibit. It really is sort of an expedition or a trek through through this environment, both cultural and animal. And so to me, that's the kind of thing that alone is different from your typical animal exhibit that you find at any zoo, and really elevates Animal Kingdom to something else, both in terms of detail and in terms of zoological type attractions.
Now, that leads me to another question I had for you. You said in the article, you say that Maharaja Jungle Trek, the Flights of Wonder, Pangani Forest, these are things that you had never done up until last year, or maybe, like you said, if you had done it, you know, it would have been years ago.
Yeah.
Now, Mike and I will resist the temptation to badger you for those years in the darkness, but the question I have, there's actually two questions here. One, what made you ignore them? And two, do you think that, I mean, I'm ascribing pundits all in one thing, but also the commando folks, like you're saying, the Disney fanatics, the people sort of the half-day parkers, so to speak, without naming names. Do you think that they also ignore this, and that is part of the problem? That is part of the perception, is just this sort of walking past these enormously themed things?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely the case with Maharaja and I don't know how you say it, Pangani, because those are walkthroughs. So I think it's easy to do with those, that you just, okay, this is a walkthrough exhibit, sort of like maybe, I mean, you don't know what it is truly without actually going to do it. So to me, it's sort of, it could be like the Oasis or one of the little trails around the Tree of Life.
Right.
People don't know until they do it, but there's this, as soon as you just hear what it is or see what it is on the map, you have a preconception about it. So, I mean, that's why, I mean, it was just a preconceived notion that I had about what that would be. And so we had never really done those two things.
And Flights of Wonder, too, which you say you're now a fan of.
Yeah, we've been back and we've done that a couple times since this article. And I think it's hilarious and a great show overall. so that, I think that's a different story. That was just probably happen chance that we had never done that. I mean, it's, I think people generally are more open to doing shows. Maybe the repeatability is lower on some shows. I think that's especially true at the studios as well. But I don't think people intentionally skip those the same way they do a walking exhibit.
Now, in the article, you say, and this is a correct quote, a direct quote, what it lacks in nostalgia for most of us, it should make up for in character. And this sentence really made me think. And I guess my question is, the lack of nostalgia, which to me kind of turns into, you know, a direct correlation with Walt or the past of the company. You know, nostalgia in that respect is what, as much as nostalgia in your own, you know, in your own life. But MGM and Epcot have, to some extent, this kind of nostalgia. Certainly, you know, MGM tried their best to sort of look like a nostalgic Hollywood from Walt's time. And we all know what Epcot was all about. But neither of those things were anywhere near the vision that Walt had for Epcot or for a studio's sort of park. Animal Kingdom doesn't have that kind of Walt nostalgia, at least not too much. How much do you think that hurts the real Disney fan? I mean, talk about that nostalgia a little bit. I like the way you brought that in, and I'm kind of interested in what you had to say there.
Yeah, I was more going for personal nostalgia, but I think that can extend to what you're talking about as well. And I think for a lot of Disney fans, it extends. I mean, they have the same personal nostalgia. They've been going, or at least for a lot of people, they've been going since they were kids, and so they haven't formed that same nostalgia. I think nostalgia is a powerful yet dangerous thing for Disney, and that they have to work around it, yet they use it artfully too to keep people coming back. In this case, I think that, I mean, it's just it's hard to fully articulate, but part of it is the personal nostalgia that people just lack for it since it's not as old as their parks. The other part of it, I think you've hit on that, even though I didn't intend that with this, that it does lack a little bit of the, not just necessarily the Walt connection, but I think people, they may have a harder time with it emotionally resonating with them, I suppose, in that sense of nostalgia. That, you know, even if you've never been to Hollywood in the Golden Age, we all certainly have ideas of what that was. I mean, we've seen it in film, or we've just, I mean, it's part of the cultural consciousness. With Epcot, I think it does have more of a Walt connection, or at least some idealized versions of places we know, like Paris, London, other areas that even if you haven't been to those, you're pretty familiar with them. Whereas the places the Animal Kingdom takes you to are a bit more off the beaten path as far as real world environments go. People probably aren't as familiar with what these parts of Africa look like, with what Asia looks like. Then you have areas like, I mean, I guess you could say the Route 66 area in Dinorama could do that, right. but that's a major stretch, I think. I don't think anyone has a whole lot of emotional resonance for that area, so.
Now, go ahead.
No, I was about wrapping it up, so that's probably a good enough spot to leave it.
Let me put two more quotes together here, and this is the question that for every person I listen to, and I'm not going to name names, every person I've ever listened to and every person I've ever read, a Disney blogger, all these people who have panned Animal Kingdom for years and years, I always come back to this one thing. You write in your article, to me, the atmosphere and the details are a big part of what separates Disney theme parks from other theme and amusement parks. And then a sentence or two later, you write, in terms of Disney details, Animal Kingdom ranks as some of Imagineering's best work. It's staggering, really, and even seasoned Animal Kingdom fans are likely to notice new things with each visit. Now, for years, I've been listening to Disney pundits telling me what they love about Disney parks is the details. Yet they all seem to have totally missed 15 years worth of these details that have made up the very fabric of the Animal Kingdom. So I guess my question is this, do they really like the details or not?
You understand what I'm asking? Yeah, I do. And I think so. I mean, it's not like I suddenly realized there were all of these details at Animal Kingdom that I've been missing all this time. I mean, obviously I knew that there were a lot of details there all along. I can't fully articulate, a response to this on behalf of other people. I can speculate why, and maybe it's because a lot of the details are not the same romanticized details you have in other parks. I'm grasping at straws here, but I think that's probably the biggest thing, where Animal Kingdom has a gritty realism in its details, whereas the other parks are more whimsical, are, you know, they're romanticized. I mean, that's exactly what they are. And I don't think it's that people are overlooking those details. They're very clear. Animal Kingdom has tons of details. It's truly bursting with detail. I think it's just maybe, once again, it's the unfamiliarity with the concept, and what they've done there is so radically different that it's not something. And I'm not saying people are uncomfortable with it, but they just don't have the same comfort level with it. And add to that the just overall difference between this park and other parks in terms of basic ride count, and you have just something that makes it easier for people to overlook, I guess. I can't really give a more clear answer to that, because I don't know what other people are thinking when they go into it. That's my speculation, though.
Right. And I'm really talking more about, because it's obvious from the numbers, and it's obvious from people that who I speak to, you know, I mean, just being a Disney fan. A lot of people, there's two types of people, right? There's the people that know everything about what they're doing in Disney, and then there's the people who don't know anything that just kind of think that the only thing that's there is the Magic Kingdom, and they just go there and then go home. There are still quite a few of those. Disney's always trying to fight against that. But I guess, you know, for the people who do appreciate it, you know, the kind of the thing that sort of confuses me about it is the way in which they're dismissive of these things. And I wonder if it really is, like you're saying, a sense of nostalgia that maybe doesn't connect to them, places that maybe are unfamiliar with them, an unromanticized thing. All those things are absolutely true. And that's what I love about it, the sense of adventure that's in it. I wonder if then you think that Animal Kingdom could ever get past that with a certain group of people, you know?
Yes, and I think this probably leads into what we're going to talk about next. I think that will happen. I mean, so there's been a lot of, I guess, unrest, you could say, and debate, and just being divisive in general over the concept of Avatar Land, or Avatar, whatever they're going to call the Avatar addition to Animal Kingdom, whether or not that's thematically appropriate, whether or not Avatar is a good vehicle for the expansion, I mean, et cetera, et cetera. That's been played out again and again. I think when that opens, and when the nighttime show Rivers of Light, that's what it's going to be called, right? I'm sorry. I didn't.
Correct. Yeah.
Yep. Okay, Rivers of Light debuts. I think that will be what, in the eyes of a lot of fans, completes the park and sort of offsets the rest of it, which is, I mean, brings it closer to the type of parks with which people are familiar, and I guess allows them to open their eyes and sort of see what else is there that's really they've been taking for granted all this time. And
Go ahead.
I think that regardless of where people stand on Avatar now, I think that if it's done well, and if it looks nice, which I think the big thing for that area, if it looks pretty, and if Rivers of Light allows Animal Kingdom to stay open late at night, which, I mean, obviously it will, as will the Avatar area, because it's not going to have real animals, then people will spend more time there just sort of by default, and its reputation will change regardless of what they think about Avatar.
One of the things you said in your article is that, and one of the things that you thought was wrong, at least to some degree, of the Animal Kingdom, was that the park itself could use more traditional theme park attractions, and I think you said that to distance it from being a zoo. So you think Avatar Land will accomplish that?
Yeah, I do think it'll accomplish that. I mean, I appreciate what's unique about Animal Kingdom, and I think that they've done a great job with all this. But with that said, I do still think it has its issues, and I would say the same thing about all three of the other parks as well. So, I mean, this isn't just me trying to be hypercritical of Animal Kingdom. Mm-hmm. I still think it does bear too close a resemblance to a zoo. I mean, it's clearly different. And I've come to realize that it's clearly different. But I think being that it is a theme park, ultimately, although albeit one centered around animals, it could use more traditional types of theme park attractions, or at least things that deviate from standard notions of what might be contained in a zoo. And I think that since Avatar Land, I mean, I would prefer Beastly Kingdom or some unique concept, but Avatar Land will do that. I mean, it can't possibly be what would be contained in a zoo, just because by its very nature, it's not real. So, go ahead.
So you would think that the park would do better with something like Beastly Kingdom or Avatar Land than as opposed to, you know, an Australia section, for example.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Unless the, now I'll, I guess I'll qualify that. I suppose it depends on what the Australia section would bring to the table, but I would presume that that would be more animal type or more animal centric exhibits and not a ride themed around animals. And I think that's the difficult thing Animal Kingdom has to accomplish. If you have more real world places, you can't really put rides in there or attractions in there that don't use real animals. I mean, that's, you go to a theme park that is an authentic type of theme park like this, you expect it. I mean, you don't expect the Jungle Cruise. That would be sort of not only disingenuous, it would be insulting, I think. So the best way to accomplish that is you have the dinosaur area, which is extinct animals, and then you have the mythical area, which is, you know, not real animals. Mm-hmm. And those are your best opportunity to put together attractions that don't utilize living creatures, because they necessarily cannot utilize living creatures.
You're not a big fan of like the carnival aspects of Dinorama, correct?
Yeah, that's an understatement, but yeah.
Well, I am kind of. I was curious as to what your problem with Dinorama and that area is.
So how much more time do we have?
you got a minute and a half.
I preface this with no offense, but I don't think that. My opinion on that is what it is. I think that area is an abomination. I think it is truly awful, and it's something sort of like, I don't like the dance parties they have in the Magic Kingdom with the contemporary music and, you know, things that I don't view as appropriate for Disney theme parks. And I don't like really the old Paradise Pier section of Disney California Adventure. I just don't think that's in keeping with a Disney theme park. No matter how thematically rich it supposedly is or how much backstory they've sort of crammed into there, it's just not something I view as being to the standards of what Disney does. And I think that's wholly in keeping with that Disney details type thing. And to me, Disney details aren't just, you know, cramming a lot of details in there, but cramming in well-designed and well-done details. And I think that a lot of people have given that Dinorama area way too much credit because of this contrived backstory it has. And I say contrived backstory, and I absolutely mean that, because to me, it looks like they said, okay, you guys have $500,000 budget for this to finish out the park. Here's what all we need done. And they said, oh, shoot, how are we going to accomplish all of this?
That's, well, clearly what they did.
We can do these cheap areas here. Well, how are we going to explain how that fits? Well, let's get to work writing something really clever to explain away how this fits in this park. And that's why I really don't like it. And I think that I'm a huge fan of dinosaurs, and I think that area has so much potential, and I think it's entirely squandered on what's there.
Do you
besides dinosaur?
Well, that's what I was going to ask. Do you like dinosaur, the ride itself?
Yeah, I think dinosaur is fine. I mean, I think that could be better too, but I'm perfectly satisfied with that.
Okay.
Well, while we're talking about attractions, Tom, one of the things you wrote in your and I just kind of want to have you explain this a little bit more. You talked about the distribution of attractions causing problems for the commando tourists. You know, the people who want to see an e-ticket as soon as possible, and then think they're, you know, they basically, what you said is they, you know, you have a couple of e-tickets, you come in, you see them, and then you think there's nothing to do. And I guess as we're talking about like the future, we're talking about Avatar and stuff, I'm wondering if you think FastPass Plus might have an effect on this whole sort of distribution of attractions kind of working against sort of the smaller attractions that are, you know, that are being missed.
Well, I think that could work to Disney's advantage. If I were, and I think this has been done to a degree, you see things like Living with the Land as a tier one FastPass Plus attraction in Epcot. If I were managing Animal Kingdom and I were charged of assigning FastPass Plus to different attractions, I would throw in several that people don't normally do. And things that don't even need FastPass Plus at all, like Maharaja maybe, just because people would then all of a sudden view that as a checklist type attraction, they would go do it. I mean, we saw this a few years ago when, I don't know if you guys recall this, but if you got a FastPass for Space Mountain, a lot of times it would spit out a surprise bonus FastPass for Carousel of Progress. And we all know that Carousel Progress has never needed FastPass. But what that did was it put a lot of people in Carousel Progress, otherwise it would not have been there. And it was a great, actually, trick for, shuffling around crowds and sort of, it is what it is. And that's what I would do if I were tasked with coming up with FastPass Plus assignments. In general, I think, though, that even though it sounds like Avatar Land is only going to have maybe, two attractions, and I think that plus Rivers of Light will be enough because you still do have those shows that a lot of people overlook. And I think that'll just, it doesn't take a whole lot to break away from that stigma of it being a half-day park. And that truly is what it is a stigma. So that's, the three of us talking here know that that's not the reality. So isn't it really just convincing people that it's not a half-day park, not really adding more substance to make it not a half-day park? So now at this point, it's just a matter of really getting people to go to those things that they already have. And I think that all it takes is these three attractions, let's say three attractions, that are pretty different from what's there now, for the most part. I think that really skews the distribution fairly significantly and will prevent the sort of fatigue that sets in for a lot of people, if that makes any sense.
It does. Mike, you have any other questions?
Well, yeah, just one. I know you're, and you actually mentioned how this could possibly replace the parade that is now actually gone. I know you're a big fan of Tokyo Disney Sea, and you mentioned the Legend of Mythica in this article here as being a good fit for Animal Kingdom. Could you just explain to me why?
Yeah, so
I don't know it. So
okay, so Legend of Mythica is a daytime water pageant, for lack of a better term, that plays in the main bay at Tokyo Disney Sea in the middle of the day, and it actually ends in September of 2014. It's basically the story, I only know it loosely, it's in Japanese, it's very abstract in nature. It's more about the pageantry of it all than it is about any sort of loose storyline. But it's basically how mythical forces have come together to create the Earth and other things. I'd have to actually look at a rundown of or a synopsis of the actual show, because I'm probably butchering that. But it really is. It shows mythical creatures, and it shows, and of course, it has a few of the Disney characters in it too. But really, the highlights of it are these mythical creatures that embody different the spirits of, I don't remember if it's like spirit of adventure, spirit of creativity, things like that. Spirit of different things. And really, though, what it is it's a cool mythical themed pageant on the water with crazy costumes, fire, like some not wind socks, some kites, jet skis. I mean, it's really one of those things you have to watch a video of it or see it in person to understand, because what I'm saying doesn't make a whole lot of sense, probably. But it's anyone who's seen it will tell you it's probably one of the most moving and incredible shows that Disney's put on. The problem is with it, I think, and the reason one of the reasons Tokyo's probably getting rid of it, it has something like 100 and some performers in it, in each showing of it, and I gather that it's very cost intensive to put on. Mm-hmm. I think that Rivers of Light will do a lot, and I would imagine at some time they're going to restore a daytime parade there too. I might be getting overzealous with the idea that it'd be nice if this Legend of Mythica show came, but I think it would be certainly very cool, and it's a show that a lot of theme park fans would love.
Is Disney Sea a good comparison for Animal Kingdom?
I think it is, to the extent that I think the foundation is there for Animal Kingdom to potentially be at that level, and by foundation I mean the details are there. It's a high concept type park, as is Disney Sea. In terms of the actual quality and what the essence of the two parks is now, I think they both thematically hit the high notes, but I think substance-wise, even as I like Animal Kingdom a lot more now, it's nowhere on par with Tokyo Disney Sea. Mm-hmm. And that's more of a testament to that park than it is a knock at Animal Kingdom, because I don't think any of the Walt Disney World theme parks are even close to on par with that one.
Well, I mean, to be honest, I mean, I've seen many people who have gone to Tokyo Disney Sea. I don't remember one person ever saying after they've seen it that it wasn't, if not their favorite, close to their favorite park. Yeah. So,
yeah, and it truly is something else. But So, and that's not, I mean, if anything, that should be viewed as praise towards Animal Kingdom, because it does have the same fundamental quality as that park, but it's just, I don't think it's there yet.
Now, last question from me before we let you go. You before said expertly ducked your way around your thoughts on Avatar and, you know, its appropriateness or whether or not you're looking forward to it or this kind of thing. So I want you to be on record here on what you feel is how Avatar will fit.
Well, I'll give you two answers. I don't think that Avatar is a great fit for Animal Kingdom. I think that Avatar is a poor movie. I know it won, you know, Best Picture and all these other Academy Awards. I think it greatly benefited from James Cameron's name being attached and it grossing so much at the box office. I don't think it's a thematically good fit. I think it will be, with that said, I'm very much looking forward to it, and I think it is a very good addition for Animal Kingdom, keeping in mind that it's not Avatar Land or Beast of the Kingdom. I mean, if I had those choices, I'd choose Beast of the Kingdom in an instant. I think what it will bring to the table is a great mythical area. And the more that they reveal, and I know they haven't really revealed anything about it, but each time they release sort of press release or something, they sort of shy away from calling it Avatar Land or giving it any particular name and saying this new area inspired by the film Avatar, which leads me to believe that maybe they're going to distance themselves from that a little. But even if they don't, even if they call it Avatar Land and everything, you know, every sign says, welcome to James Cameron's exciting Avatar Land based on Avatar 1, 2, and 3. You know, I think that the quality of the movie doesn't really matter if the environments are exceptional, if the attractions are exceptional. I mean, I've compared it to Song of the South in the past, that people don't love Splash Mountain because they have this affinity for Song of the South. They love it because, you know, it's an engaging attraction with a really cool environment and well-done storytelling. I think I'm especially excited for the boat ride. I think if this whole area has beautiful environments, and Avatar certainly does lend itself to some beautiful designs, regardless of the actual quality of the movie, I think that it will be a hit. And I would just love to see something like Living with the Land, except with a bunch of, you know, phosphorescent things and just crazy plant life and really cool imagery. And I think that that's, if Avatar Land is going to, or whatever it's going to be called, is going to succeed, it's going to succeed because it just has this beautiful aesthetic and some really striking visuals and things like that. I don't think it'll be because it's really staying true to the movies or whatever, because I don't think that's how it succeeds.
So you think it will? You think they can pull it off?
I do think they can pull it off. And I think that the other thing that sort of gives me some hope with this is, you know, James Cameron is notoriously difficult to work with and a perfectionist. And if he has any sort of pull with this, he'll make sure that it's done right and, you know, sort of brings his visions to life in a respectful way. And it won't be, you know, a budget cut, cheap addition. I think that it will be a fully thought through and fruitful addition to the parks. I think they will pull it off. And at least I hope so. So we'll see. I mean, I don't like the movie Cars, but I think Cars Land is about the coolest theme park edition in a long time. So
that's a comparison I think a lot of people make. Mm-hmm. I know Mike makes that comparison quite a bit,
right,
using Cars Land. Listen, Tom, thank you very much for coming on.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be on.
Before we let you go, please tell people where they can read, what you do. I'll find everything about you.
I post my photos and thoughts on DisneyTouristBlog.com, and from there you can find my various social media accounts in the top right hand corner, and, you know, see my photos and my random Twitter thoughts and things like that.
Well, again, thank you very much, and thanks everybody for listening to Radio Harambe. Before we go, let me remind you to check out our store, Zazzle.com/JonBoEveryone. We have the very appropriate Not a Half Day Park t-shirts on sale there. Also, our very own fellow writer for JonBoEveryone.com, Brooke, she's making some gorgeous animal-inspired, kind of safari-inspired bracelets. You can go to our blog, click the link of the picture of the bracelet, and go and find out how we can do this. Everything we're doing here, obviously, is going towards our conservation partners, as well as the brand new t-shirts that we told you about earlier in the show. And You're going to want to see those. Please visit us at thejomboeveryone.com. And as I mentioned before, while you're there, visit our conservation page. See how we can all help save wildlife. You can find me on Twitter. I'm at Radio Harambe. Mike is at Jombo Everyone. We're also on Facebook, YouTube, everything, yada, yada, yada. Please subscribe to the show on iTunes. Rate and leave us a review. And, of course, thank you again to Tom Bricker of the Disney Tourist blog. So for Safari Mike and for Mr. Bricker, I am Dave McBride. Kwa Harini, go well, and thank you for listening to Radio Harambe. Takuna.